Welcome to the Audiobook Speakeasy. I'm Rich Miller, and I'm your host here at the Speakeasy. This is where you'll meet narrators, coaches, engineers, and other audiobook professionals, as well as some listeners who'll be sharing what they look for in a good audiobook. If you're interested in audiobook production, you've come to the right place. So come on in, grab a drink, pull up a chair, and join us for a friendly chat about audiobooks. My guest tonight has been interested in the audiobook world for a long time now. She is the founder and editor of Audiophile Magazine, which has been reviewing audiobooks, original audio programs, and spoken word programs for over 25 years. Robin Witten, thanks for joining me in the Speakeasy tonight.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
I'm so glad you could make it. I know we had a little difficulty scheduling, but you've been busy in the audiobook world, so I'm really glad that we finally found a time that we could get together for a drink.
Right, right. And yes, I'm always in the audiobook world, sometimes busier than others.
No matter where you go, you are in the audiobook world.
Well, that's a nice thing these days, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The audiobook industry, boy, for the past few years now, at least three, it might be four or five, is just continuing to boom. So you, a long time ago, you got into a specific industry and it was a good call because it's taken off now.
Yes. And I am so glad that I do not have to explain what an audiobook is any longer.
I'm sure a long time ago, people were like, what?
Yes. Oh, yes. Blind grandmothers. And, you know, it went on. But, you know, I'm glad I don't have to do that anymore because it's on the radar, on everybody's radar. So.
Yeah, it really is. All right. Well, that's great. So Robin, what are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking a little scotch.
Oh, nice. What kind of scotch do you have?
Oh, I'm a Dewar's girl.
Ah, so. Dewar's, yes. Is it the white label or the 12-year-old or one of the lesser known ones?
No, just the regular old stuff.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I have no problem with Dewar's. It's one of the ones that is fairly common in airlines. And so if I'm in the mood for scotch, I know that Dewar's will probably be on the menu.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. Good stuff. Not all of them. They're all different, but I know that I have seen it on several different airlines. So good stuff. And do you like your scotch neat or do you like it with ice?
I like it with ice.
All right. I usually get a little bit of ice to cool it down, but I tend to keep it a little hot and not use too much ice. But there are so many different ways to drink scotch and they're all good. I am joining you tonight with something new for me. I have actually never tried this before, and it just came to me today for the first time. I'm actually having a rum margarita.
Oh, you are in a warm climate.
I am. I don't know why this came to me, but I just thought, you know, it's tropical, sure, and Mexico is certainly tropical, but I've actually had a couple of different bottles of rum recently, and I've been doing a little tasting, and I have found one that I really like. And so I thought, I bet that would go really well in a margarita. And I have to say, from the first couple of sips, I think that was a good call because I'm really enjoying it. It kind of makes me think of something like a butter rum lifesaver. So it's different, and I'm enjoying it. So thank you very much for coming in tonight. Cheers.
Cheers to you.
All right. So, Robin, where are you located right now? I know that you're on the East Coast someplace.
Well, I am. I'm in Portland, Maine, which was my comment about the warm climate because, you know, rum and margaritas seem to be a warm drink. Right now, it's in the 40s. We had snow in the mountains last night. So, you know, it's fall and edging towards winter. The gloves and hat.
40s. Yeah, we get the 40s here in Tucson usually about 3 days a year, and it's usually sometime in January or February. Every once in a while, I mean, the first year that I lived here 6 years ago, we actually had a really cold winter that year, and there was a cold snap where I don't think the highs even got into the 40s for 3 or 4 days in a row, which is really unusual here. No, right now it's in I think today the high is supposed to be in the low 80s and it'll be that way for another week or two, maybe three, maybe four. but yes, it is definitely warmer than Portland, Maine. I am sure of that. And,
so we're heading into beautiful, you know, it's a beautiful time of year, New England, the foliage, all those things, but it is a little chilly.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's one thing that I have never done is gone out that way for any kind of the leaf turning thing. And I know it is a big tourist draw. Someday I might actually get out there to see that, but haven't done it yet. So that's where you are now. Where are you from originally? Have you been there your whole life?
No, I'm from New England. I grew up in a tiny little corner of Massachusetts called Deerfield, Massachusetts, where we had beautiful foliage also, and, you know, lots of New England weather. It sort of must have been in my blood because when I grew up and had to move somewhere with my husband, we came to Maine over 40 years ago.
Wow. So you have been there for a good long time. And I assume that Massachusetts, it's probably also going to be relatively cold there. But I have to guess that Maine, just being that much farther north, is going to be colder sooner and longer.
Oh, sometimes. But we're on the coast. Portland is on the ocean. So mm-hmm. that helps to moderate the temperatures. So, you know, yes, it's winter.
And if you've been there for a long time, clearly you like it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. We do. Very much.
That's great. Did you go to do any university work or what did you do for education?
I got an education.
That's good.
I graduated from college a long time ago. We don't have to talk about that.
That's fine.
And, you know, I was thinking about it and I was thinking, well, you know, what I studied has absolutely nothing to do with starting a magazine or running a magazine. But I do remember that the whole tenor of my education was, you want to do something? Sure, whatever you want to do, you can do it. You just have to learn about what you want to do and do it. And that's sort of the way I fell into publishing a magazine, because I certainly didn't know anything about publishing when I decided that this was a good idea in 1992.
So what did you focus on when you were at school then? Because what you're describing is very familiar to me. I feel like I was a math major in college, and arguably, I used some of what I learned in college later when I got into programming, because you got the logic and et cetera, et cetera. But for the most part, I found that the most important aspect of going to secondary education was learning how to learn, so that when I wanted to do something, no matter what it was, whether it had anything to do with my major or not, I actually could get into it relatively quickly instead of not having any idea. So what did you focus on in school?
Oh, well, I was an art history major, which really has a lot to do with publishing and writing.
Right, right. But it is creative. I always like to think of, you know, if you've got something that has creativity in it, that helps you go into something else with creativity in it.
Right. And to dig into, you know, into the backstory of whatever you're interested in, I think that has a lot to do with being interested in books. And, you know, when I discovered audiobooks, that was a totally different thing. I mean, that just changed my whole thinking about stories, storytelling, enjoying literature in a different way, all those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So when did you discover audiobooks? I know that Audiophile magazine was started in 92, like you said. When did you actually discover audiobooks?
Well, I would say, you know, maybe late 1980s, around 1990. I was doing a lot of traveling in Maine at a time when there was not great radio reception and in lots of places. And so I would, a friend of mine who was had done a lot of traveling as a salesperson said, you know, really, you should listen to audiobooks. You can get them from the library. I'm like, what, Annie? What does that mean? What is that? She said, yeah, no, just go try one. And I did. And I was hooked. Pretty much great.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's around the same time that I listened to my first audiobook. I think that for me, it was probably a couple of years earlier. It might have been 86 or 87. But I was working with a guy and he said, so you got to listen to this. I found out you could like listen to books. And so I got this and I'm like, what are you talking about? And it was on cassettes. Of course, it was, there were no CDs at the time. And, so he gave me this audiobook to listen to, for as long as he had. I think he had checked it out as well. I don't think he bought it. But it was on medical, one of those medical detective things. In fact, I think the title may have been Medical Detectives. And it was all these weird stories of people having just bizarre problems that it took, you know, a team of different types of physicians to figure out. And it was really kind of fascinating. And it was also sort of fascinating being able to listen to it in my car as I was driving to work. So it sounds like kind of a similar start there. So a few years later then, you decided, I'm going to start publishing a magazine.
Well, yes, it was a little like that. I was on the board of the Portland Public Library, and the director and I used to chat about audiobooks. And we would talk about, you know, what we'd listen to or what was, you know, on the shelf. And I, you know, we chatted about the fact that there was very little information about what was a good audiobook. Mm-hmm. And somehow I got in my mind that it would be a good idea to write reviews of the good audiobooks, the best audiobooks, the most interesting ones. And he encouraged me. I did some research and I thought, oh, this is, you know, this is an easy thing. You know, that desktop publishing thing you do on your computer now. Yeah. I could do a newsletter. Wow, that would be fun. So that's how it sort of started. That's where it originally started.
So it started as kind of a, not exactly a hobby thing. It was related to, you know, you having an in the book world because you were on a library board. But it started as, it sounds like it started as sort of a hobby-ish kind of thing. It's not like you were thinking, I'm going to start a magazine and take over the publishing world.
No, right. You know, I thought, oh, this is an interesting project that would be fun to do. You know, as I was trying to dig in and learn a little bit about newsletters, because it started as a newsletter, who would read it? How do you get it to people to read? You know, what do you have to, you know, all these questions you have to ask.
Sure. Yeah. All the marketing.
But it wasn't my intention to take over the publishing world, of course.
But now look what's happened. I mean, geez, 25 plus years later, and everybody in the audiobook world knows of Audiophile magazine. So that's great. I'm sure that wasn't an overnight thing, but look what's happened. That's fantastic.
Yes. Well, it's exciting now because people are excited about the format. I mean, you can talk about audiobooks anywhere. People say, oh yeah, you know, whether they're interested in the business of it or the pleasure of it, you know, both of those things, people would love to talk about audiobooks.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. I certainly love talking about them here in the audiobook speakeasy.
Of course.
So how has the magazine changed over the years? I mean, clearly now you've got the online presence and it's huge compared to when you first started with a newsletter. How has it changed for you over the years?
Well, I think there are many things that have changed and we can talk a little bit about that. But the thing that has not changed pretty much at all is the reviews. So we do reviews in Audiophile based on the performance of the audiobook primarily. And we have done that since day one in 1992. So although we have lots of different people doing the reviews and there are many more of them, the core of everything we do is a review and a recommendation. And it's exactly the same as we started.
That's excuse me. That's great that you've been able to keep the focus exactly where you started it. When you first started Audiophile, how many reviews were you getting? I know that I just heard, I think it was on your latest podcast episode, they were talking about the number of reviews. I think that's where it was. And I certainly want to talk about the podcast as well. But it seems to me that the number I heard was something in the neighborhood of 50 a week. And I'm wondering, when you first started the magazine, how many reviews did you have at that time?
Well, in the first few issues, we had about 25 a month.
Okay.
You're right. It's 50 a week that we're doing. And that's a lot more.
Yeah, substantial increase. I'm sure you didn't have quite as many reviewers back then. Not a need for as many reviewers back then either.
That's right. But, you know, all of the what has changed tremendously is all the different platforms and the way that we reached listeners and different people with recommendations and reviews, because it was simply the print newsletter. That was it. That's all we had.
And was that something that you mailed out to a mailing list that you put together over time, or was that something that was initially just available at the libraries where you were on the board, or how did you get that into people's hands back then?
I think that initially we did purchase a library mailing list, because initially we thought, you know, librarians use reviews to make selections mm-hmm. for the audiobook collections. So that would be the logical audience. So initially it was mostly for librarians, either for purchase or for, reference in the library.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any advertising back then from any of the publishers who were doing audiobooks? I know that initially, I mean, back at that point, audiobooks were not such a big thing. So I'm just wondering if anybody was at that point was thinking, oh, this is going to take off someday.
Well, we did. We got great support. I didn't start it until I could find some visible means of support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. Good business choice.
Really early on, Recorded Books was very much in favor of us doing this. Books on tape in the original form with Duval Hecht, who was their founder. There were library-centric publishers who were really interested in helping as much as we could. So it was great.
Yeah, that sounds really good. It's certainly a good business choice to make sure that it can be supported when you're starting out. So now it's not I know that you still have the print version as well, but I assume that the majority of people who are taking advantage of Audiophile Magazine are doing it online.
Yes, I absolutely. I
mean, when did that change happen?
I think it has, the number of people that we reach with our newsletter is our biggest, group. That's the biggest audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to know, a bit about our website, and our newsletters are designed to, send people to our website for more.
Sure.
So our website probably is has more visitors, but we reach out directly with our email newsletters to almost 80,000 listeners every
week.
Wow,
that's great.
So that's, it depends how you're counting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I understand. But that's great. And so clearly you still have a lot of support. I assume that now there are a lot more publishers who are interested in what you're doing, just because now they're in audiobooks as well.
Of course. Right. Yeah. They are. We get a lot of good support from publishers, large and small, and even from indie authors and publishers. We've tried to make a special area in the print magazine and on the website so that we can feature smaller publishers independent authors who are publishing their own titles.
That's great. So it's not just for the big books that millions of people buy. As somebody who is, a small operator, not a big publishing company, I always appreciate hearing stuff like that, no matter what the industry is. It's always great when the people who are a little bit farther down the chain have an opportunity as well. So that's great. Right.
And, you know, I think one of the things I always say is that we are trying to discover great listening experiences for our audiences. And, you know, whatever we might have to say about John Grisham's new book, he doesn't really need us.
Yeah. Yep. But, he's made it.
And, you know, in all of the marketing that goes on around the big books, sometimes a review or a special focus on the audiobook gets a little lost. And so we are delighted that we can, you know, kind of go deeper into the published audiobook lists and find things that otherwise might not be getting someone's attention. And we say, oh, this is fantastic. You got to listen to this. Mm-hmm. You know, it might not be a subject that would pop right up. It's not going to be on the bestseller list, but, you know, we love to find those and talk about why that would be a great recommendation for a listener.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that, especially with the new podcast, which I want to get to in a second. Yeah. One more question about changes over time, since you've been a part of the industry for so long now, since it was on cassette tapes, which probably some of the audience members don't even know what those are. So it sounds like Audiophile Magazine has really not changed a lot. Of course, you've gotten new technology, now you're on the web, and it's bigger, so it has grown. But like you were saying earlier, the focus is on the reviews, and that has been the focus from the beginning. So it hasn't changed in that respect all that much. But from your perspective, how have you seen the audiobook industry change over the years?
Well, let's see, a couple things about the industry. Certainly when I started, there was the whole debate over abridged and unabridged audiobook.
Right, yeah.
I don't have to deal with that anymore.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that's good. And certainly the number of books that come to audio has grown tremendously. I mean, that is, you know, you can just look at the industry numbers of, you know, 5 years ago, they were publishing 12,000 audiobooks about, and now last year, over 46,000 audiobooks.
That is quite a jump.
So, you know, that's exciting for listeners, mm-hmm. but it's also a big challenge for us to review enough of those to really feel like we're, you know, digging deep into the lists and, you know, finding the best stuff, finding, you know, as many as we can. And we've increased how many audiobooks we review, as we talked about earlier.
Right.
We try to cope with that, but that's a big increase, you know, which is great. It's great for listeners because there's so many more choices, but for us to come and, you know, say, we're going to review this, but we're not going to review that, you know, that's hard.
kind of ties your hands a little because it's not like you can review 47,000 audiobooks a year.
No.
Yeah, a little bit difficult. One question that I have for you, since you listen to a lot of audiobooks and you work with a lot of people who listen to a lot of audiobooks, two things that that I notice about what's going on now and that generates a little bit of buzz and people talk about it is full cast recordings and audiobooks where it's more like a radio play and you've got sound effects and music and all kinds of things. How do you feel about those two items, just out of curiosity, from what you've listened to and from what you hear from other reviewers?
I think that the multicast audio drama style of an audio story is very interesting. I don't think it's for everyone. I think some listeners like it, some others don't. You know, it's not suited for every story or every book. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's so much opportunity there, and it's a very long tradition of wonderful audio theater, you know, with sound effects and casts and, you know, the whole audio storytelling. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I'm glad to see sort of a bit of a revival of that in the last few years.
Yeah. I find it really interesting. I'm still not sure exactly how I feel about it in terms of listening to audiobooks, but I love the idea of the radio play. I was fascinated the first time that I saw a kind of a recreation of what the Foley artists, the live Foley artists, oh, yeah, used to do for those back like in the 40s and 50s. And I was fascinated that somebody could be so deft at making all these different sounds. Of course, they know what's coming. It's not like it's improv. But every once in a while, if something goes wrong and it's live, it is improv. So I find it really interesting. But I'm just very curious about how those trends are going to go in the coming 5 or 10 years. It is the focus seems to have shifted quite a bit in the past. I would guess 10 or 15 years to really performance based, more so than more of a dry read that I think was popular 30 years ago. So I'm really curious to see how those aspects of the performance work change over time.
Right. Well, of course, as the audience grows, that gives more opportunity to draw an audience that might like a bigger story experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. The bigger the audience is, the more chance there is for innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so speaking of listening to audiobooks and getting people interested, the latest thing that Audiophile Magazine is doing is the Behind the Mic podcast. So tell me how that came about.
Well, this is a long story, sort of like Audiophile's long story.
It's just you and me. We got all night.
Well, you know, it started a long time ago, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I had always thought that because this is an audio medium, in the very earliest days of podcasts, which is not, you know, just a few years ago, not a year before Serial, but
sure, yeah,
many years ago, that there should be an audiobook podcast. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't sure exactly what that meant. It's an audio medium. We should be talking about audiobooks. How do we do that? And Audiophile we experimented with a few things. I did some podcasts talking about different books. Read reviews of, you know, tried to just sort of take the review and read it as a podcast. That didn't work at all. And so we tried this for a number of years in a different ways. Most recently, we had been doing a sort of scripted description of a recommended audiobook on the SoundCloud platform.
Mm-hmm.
And as this interest in podcasts, the new interest in podcasts, the long form stories, the short commentaries, the conversations. And I knew there was something else. I knew we had to do something else. And in the last year, I've been experimenting with a wonderful colleague of mine, Josephine Reed, who is a radio show host and audio person, who we've done radio interviews together. She used to work on the This Is Audible radio show when they had it on XM Sirius.
Oh.
Goes back a bit. She was their host. We used to talk about audiobooks on the show. And together, we've sort of worked out a new form that has become Behind the Mic with Audiophile Magazine, which is a very short daily podcast where we recommend and talk about one audiobook. Then the next day, we talk and recommend another audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
We play a little clip from the audiobook, but it's very short and sweet. We're just saying, this is what we're recommending. This is why. Here's a little bit of it. some quirky kind of personal conversation about why Joe or I or whoever is, because we have several editors who are doing this, talk about each one. So it's very short. And then we've also added in a few bonus podcasts, which are an episode that is a long interview. Because we wanted to be able to explore with an author or a narrator just a little bit more long form interview. And so we use those as sort of a bonus episode once a month.
Well, yeah. I have to say, I love both of those aspects. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I have for about 4 years now. And in fact, I've come to the sad conclusion at this point that I'm subscribed to too many, because I am finding myself constantly pushing things down the list, and then I don't get to it and have to delete it. I've really got to go through and decide what are the core things that I'm going to listen to here in between narrating and listening to audiobooks, and actually having a life and talking to my wife. So I have been listening to a lot of podcasts, and when I found out that Audiophile was going to be doing one, I thought, oh my God, how am I going to add this to my list? So I love the fact that it is a 5 minute or less clip that I can listen to really, really quickly. I can hear a narrator very briefly, and I can hear Joe and whoever it is that she's talking with, whether it's you or Michelle or whoever it is, briefly describe why it is that they are recommending it. So I love that format, I have to tell you. I'm so glad that that was through the evolution of Behind the Mic. I'm so glad that that's what you ended up with, was a short one.
Well, it's exciting to try this. I mean, there are not very many short podcasts. So
nope.
We're going against the tide.
Yeah. Well, I think it's great. And I also love the two interviews that I've heard so far, especially Michael Imperioli, because anybody who knows me knows that I'm about the biggest Sopranos fan in the country. I've seen the entire series probably, I don't know, 24 times.
Oh, wow.
And I know that I knew that he had directed several episodes. I think it's several episodes. And I believe that I saw at one point that he had written an episode. It sounds like it may be more than one. And I know that in one of the episodes that I like, the Ballad of Tennessee Moltisanti, that's when we get into the fact that he's a writer. He thinks of himself as the character thinks of himself as a writer. And listening to the interview with him, since he's now written a book and has narrated that book, so performed it, listening to that interview was great for me, because I could just see his character in that show and how his personal experience probably informed his acting in that episode. So I thought that that was fascinating.
Oh, he was great. They covered so much territory.
Indeed, yeah.
You know, Michael's, you know, being on the set of The Sopranos, which was kind of exciting. You know, working with Spike Lee, working with Martin Scorsese. I mean, it's just, he goes all over. And then he starts talking about the difference between being a television actor or stage actor and the audiobook booth.
I love that.
He really hated it the first time. He felt, closed in and just, thought it was terrible.
I loved it when he went into the differences, and hearing A-list performer who, you have A-list performers that are doing audiobooks, but hearing his Behind the Mic take about it and saying, wow, this was really difficult. It was like, thank you. it was great hearing from him.
Yeah. So that's the kind of fun things, the little gems that come out of the long interviews in these episodes for Behind the Mic. But the short ones are very fun. And because we have four people that are doing, each of us do a week of recommendations. We get to pick, like five books. Like I'm starting to pick my next five books for the week. And, what am I going to say? Why am I really interested? Why did I get interested in this? Why, should someone else be interested? What is special about that performance?
Sure.
And, get it down to a few comments, because we got to get it in under 3-4 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. Very fun. No, it's great. I have to say that as a podcast listener, I've really been enjoying it. I love the music you guys selected too. It's just, it's so distinctive, and it's not distinctive because it's harsh or loud or I don't know. It's distinctive. So now every time it starts, I'm like, oh, good. I like this. good stuff.
Wow. Great.
Yeah, no, I'm really enjoying it. So I think I've retweeted a couple of things about it. I should probably do that more just because I think it's a great resource.
Oh, well, it is great because it's very hard since we don't have, we're not part of a big platform. We don't, we're trying to do all the marketing ourselves. So anyone who listens and leaves a review on iTunes, it makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I certainly understand that.
as we go and we're learning, because it's a little bit like the magazine, I didn't know anything much about starting a magazine. I just kind of went along and people said, oh, you ought to do this. And oh, you ought to do that. So I take advice. I take comments pretty well most of the time.
Yeah.
And that's where we are with a podcast.
Well, that's great. That reminds me that to go and leave a review, because I certainly know that those reviews are important and helpful. And it's also good to hear if somebody has a comment, even if it might not be 100% positive, to make you think and yes. Say, oh, well, maybe I should look at doing something a little different. So I certainly enjoy it. I will head on over to iTunes and leave a review. So getting back to the core business of Audiophile Magazine, do you see any changes in the near term on what you're focusing on? You've been focusing on reviews for 26 years now. Is the plan to continue in that direction, or are you going to break out and do something totally different next year?
Well, we're breaking out and doing different platforms, like taking on this podcast thing with Behind Me. Okay. But I think we will continue to find ways to get our recommendations out to other people. I mean, one of the initiatives that we've been working on the last year is trying to find partners in this would be mostly websites and blog partners who have an audience. For instance, if you're a sci-fi fantasy fan, you might know the site File 770.
I am not familiar with that one. I'm not a huge sci-fi fan, but I'm actually more of a fan than I was maybe 5 years ago, because I've done a few science fiction titles. And when I was younger, I loved reading science fiction, all the classics, Ray Bradbury and H.G. Wells and all the classic stuff. And so now I'm actually sort of going back in that direction. So I'll have to look that up.
So, they have a huge fan base. Now, there are people there on their site that are really interested in the genres and the books that are coming out. And they're talking about books and probably many of them are audiobook listeners, but there's no one on the site who's talking about audiobooks. So we've contacted Mike, who runs the site, and said, hey, can we just send you some audiobook recommendations a couple times a year? This is sci-fi for your fans. He thinks that's great because he doesn't have people who are talking about audiobooks or the audiobook versions of some of these things.
Yeah.
So that is something where we sort of are trying to go where the fans are and say, hey, we can talk about audiobooks. You've got the interest in the subject. Let's talk about the narrators, or let's talk about audiobooks that we're really excited about in the genre, whatever it is. So that's kind of different for us.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Sounds like a good partnership. And I'm sure that there are sites for other genres as well. I mean, as everybody knows, romance is a huge genre. So I know that there are sites for that as well. And it sounds like partnerships like that could certainly work out to everyone's advantage.
Yes. Yes, we hope so.
That's great. So how does one go about getting an audiobook reviewed by Audiophile Magazine? Is it just submissions from publishers? Can anybody say, oh, listen to this? Or how does that work?
No, we get submissions from publishers. They send us pretty much everything they publish. But we also take submissions from any rights holders, or, you know, also you can certainly send us information if you're a narrator and are very excited about a performance you've done or a title that was just, you know, blew your mind when you thought, wow, this is really something unexpected. I want to make sure that Audiophile pays attention to that. You can send an email to editor@audiophilemagazine.com, and we will send you information about how to submit a digital review copy, or just so all we need to know is a little bit about what the book is and why we should be paying attention to it.
And how do you go about deciding? I mean, like we were talking earlier, it's not like you can review 47,000 audiobooks a year. And even if you're doing, I think it's 50 a week, you know, you're looking at 200, 250 a month, something like that. That's, I'm guessing that that's a relatively small percentage of the requests that you get to review audiobooks. So how do you guys go about, or how do you personally, I'm not sure, go about deciding which books get reviewed? Is it just you, or is there a committee?
No. Our managing editor, Jennifer Dowell, and works on a lot of this, sort of our overview on all the submissions. And of course, you know, we take books that are being talked about and look particularly promising. We take books that are, and we pick them. Let's see, I should explain the hierarchy. We take out of all of the books that are published, we have to take a first cut and say, we should consider this for review. Mm-hmm. And that consider for review cut takes, you know, authors that we know about, narrators that have done really good work before. It could include a book that sounds really interesting. It could be a book that's being talked about a lot in the media, or a culturally important or sort of timely title for mm-hmm. one reason or another. Lots of different reasons for that. Those books go into, you know, prospects for review. Then they go into the next level where I do a match with our reviewers. So I'll tell you a funny story today. We are going to focus on food and eating and cooking for the month of November.
Okay. There's a lot of eating happening at the end of the month. I know that.
Yes. And there's a lot of preparation, and there's a lot of, you know, thinking about what we're going to be eating. And so we were looking, collecting reviews of course, all the chef memoirs and all the various books about food. And so I said, well, I should look at in the notebooks on anything that has to do with food and chefs and cooking to make sure we've got everything we have reviewed for this month. So one I came across that I had not put to the top of the list was a title called Chop Suey, The History of Chinese Food in America. Mm. So I thought, well, you know, we got to see what this is. It sounds quirky. It sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Don't know the author. Know very little about it. Let's give it a try. So we assigned it today with the hopes that in the month of November, we'll know more about the history of chop suey.
That's great. That makes me think of an episode of The Andy Griffith Show, which, of course, was in the 60s. So I'm sure that outside of Chinatowns, Chinese food in rural United States was not anything like actual Chinese food. And I believe the name of the restaurant was something like Chop Suey House or something like that. Everybody had to order that. So I look forward to hearing what you guys think of that.
Right. Well, so the process is, you know, a very straightforward in some ways. It's very quirky in some ways. We like to put a little spin on something that is personal. But, you know, we also, because we do get recommendations from narrators who say, you know, I perform a lot of audiobooks, but this, you know, these two books that I've done in the last couple months are really fabulous. So we put those into the to be reviewed notebooks. And as I said, then the next step is for me to find a reviewer and match them with the Chop Suey or with the History of Rome or whoever it is.
Right, right. So multi-step process, but pretty much anybody who's listening could submit an audiobook, whether they're a rights holder or a narrator or a publisher, whoever.
Correct.
All right. Sounds good. Well, you have clearly listened to countless audiobooks. I don't imagine that you've kept a count. I'm sure it's in the hundreds, if not the tens of thousands. Based on all the audiobooks that you've listened to over, you know, the past couple of decades, what sort of advice can you offer to aspiring narrators out there? Of all the things that you've heard, what stands out, good and bad?
About for aspiring narrators?
Yeah.
Read reviews.
Read reviews. All right. That's good to know. Why do you say that?
Well, you have to read reviews and then you have to listen to somebody else, you know. Now, this is, I think there's quite diverse opinions about this. Some narrators listen to other performances all the time and learn from them. Some narrators will never listen to somebody else. I like to point to the idea that if you're interested in theater and performing on stage, most people usually go to the theater and watch other performances because they learn. If you could make the analogy with movies, but it's a bit of a stretch. But theater is, you know, if you don't go to the theater and you don't watch other people then perform, then, you know, how do you just dream up your own performance every time? I don't know. Maybe you do. I'm not an actor. So my recommendation is that narrators listen to performances that get great reviews, that win awards. Try to figure out what you like or don't like.
Yep. Nope. That makes a lot of sense. So when you say read reviews, you're talking about read reviews of other narrators and listen to their work and see how those narrators work when they've gotten a lot of good reviews. Am I getting that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so there's a lot of debate in the narrator community about whether or not to read reviews on Audible of your own work and how much stock to put in those reviews. I'm one of the people who's in the camp of, oh no, I read all the reviews, and of course I don't like it when I get a bad review, but I try to step back after saying, you idiot, I try to step back and say, look, if they had a problem, maybe that's something I should look at. Maybe there's something there. Maybe there's not. But I can at least try to analyze what the complaint was. There are a lot of narrators out there who refuse to read any reviews. And it makes me think that there's a longstanding tradition in the theater that a lot of actors don't read reviews that come out in the papers because they don't want to see anything negative while they're performing in a show. And I get that. I don't think that there's anything wrong with either camp. I just wanted to make sure that I got that I understood you correctly when you were talking about reading reviews.
But I'm talking about reading other people's reviews.
Got it.
Not necessarily your own reviews. I mean, I understand if you don't want to read your own reviews.
Sure. No, I just wanted to make sure I had that right.
And you know, there is a difference between an Audible review and an audiophile review that we should probably put in here a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
That, you know, if I'm a listener and I've listened to something I really like, I tell you, wow, I really liked this. I love those characters. I thought that was great. What a great thing. I'm going to give it 5 stars. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if I'm writing that same, a review of that same listening experience for audiophile, I'm going to say something a little different because I'm going to try to be specific about what it was that I really liked, not just somebody's voice. Oh, I really liked his voice. Mm-hmm. You know, I really liked how he created such tension between these characters who, you know, their animosity was really a part of what the whole story. Mm-hmm. So that you've got to be specific. You've got to tell us really why this is something that we expect of the audiophile reviewers. You've got to be specific. I liked it a lot is for Audible reviews.
Right.
The specifics of why you liked it a lot is for a professional review.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Is there anything that comes to mind on things that as you've listened to a book to review it, stick out as something that you really don't like, whether it's a personal preference or because clearly there's a problem with a performance?
Something that sticks out.
No names, no titles. Just wondering if there have been things that you've listened to and you've thought, oh yeah, this just really isn't working for me. And if you analyzed why it was that it didn't work.
Well, a couple things. Let's see. I really am bothered when place names are not correct.
Oh, pronunciation.
Pronunciations.
Yeah.
especially if it's in a region that I know something about.
Sure, yeah.
Really inexcusable. You know, you can pass that buck along to any number of people, but it's inexcusable for a final audiobook to have place names that are not correct.
Right.
I think maybe my other little peeve is that I keep noticing someone's voice.
And that takes you out of the story?
It takes me out of the story.
Yeah.
I don't want to be thinking that's a beautiful voice. I want to be thinking that's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a beautiful sentence. You know, that's just, you know, an amazing character. Mm-hmm. Because I need to be inside what the author has written. That just is one of the things that is almost immediately apparent to me when I start to listen to something.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be right in that story immediately.
Sounds like great advice. I'm sure that will help a lot of people out. Well, Robin, this has been great. I'm so glad that we could work out a time when you could come in and have a drink in the speakeasy. I hope the scotch is going down well. My rum margarita is almost gone.
All right. Well, Rich, it's been great. Fun talking. Enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, it has been great. Thank you so much for coming in, Robin. And I look forward to hearing more behind the mic episodes in little short bites that I can get no matter what else I'm listening to.
Great. Well, please do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, that's it for tonight. Many thanks to Robin Witten for coming in. I really enjoyed hearing how Audiophile Magazine has gone from a newsletter with 25 audiobook reviews a month to a magazine with a huge subscriber base and 50 audiobook reviews a week, and I hope you did too. You can find the Audiobook Speakeasy on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean, and all the apps that pull from iTunes. And you can find me at richvoiceproductions.com, where I've got some samples and links to audiobooks I've narrated, and where I'm also posting episodes of the Audiobook Speakeasy. If you're enjoying our speakeasy chats, please leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're not enjoying them, please find a podcast you do enjoy and leave them a review. If you think this show is educational, entertaining, or valuable simply because it gives you an excuse to sit down and enjoy a cocktail in an otherwise hectic day, I'd really appreciate it if you'd add a buck or two to the tip jar. You can make a per-episode donation by signing up at patreon.com/audiobookspeakeasy, or you can make a one-time donation by visiting paypal.me/audiobookspeakeasy. Any financial support is greatly appreciated and helps me keep the lights on here in the speakeasy. Until we see you here in the speakeasy again, I hope you can find some time to enjoy an audiobook. Cheers!
Mm-hmm.